This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast in online Main Street across North Dakota. Today we'll start our show with Rich LeMay. He's the Executive Director for Legal Assistance of North Dakota, and he joins us from Minot. Thanks for being with us, Rich.
Yes, thanks for having me, Doug.
Let's just start with a big, wide overview question. How has the pandemic changed operations for Legal Assistance of North Dakota?
Well, it's changed it in many ways, probably not unlike anybody else providing services to residents in North Dakota. We've stopped our face-to-face meetings with people. We did that back in March, and we've adapted. You know, in the beginning of March, we moved our intake system to people working at home. We've secured some funding that it's allowed us to really have all of our staff essentially work from home. Of course, we have somebody in the office probably on a daily basis, but we rotate that. So we never have all of our staff in an office all at one time. As careful as people try to be out in the community, I mean, that's our biggest problem, is community spread. So rather than having everybody in the office and everybody contracting it if somebody happens to get it, I think this way has protected our staff and has allowed us to continue our mission.
Well, how would you describe the pace of activity in your office? Is it up? Is demand up for help? Or is it stable?
Well, I think in April and probably for part of March and part of May, people were, occupied with the pandemic. They were concerned about other things, but we didn't get nearly as many calls. And in fact, I think since May, our numbers have continued to increase. Till now, we're probably about, 18 to 20% behind what we were last year.
Okay. How would you rank the issues that prompt people to ask for your help? What's number one?
Well, number one is undoubtedly housing. Then I would say just in pure applications, unemployment compensation would be the second, then domestic violence and bankruptcy. And the way I'm gauging that is if our total numbers are down by 20%, then everything should be down by 20%. In these particular areas, we're having the same numbers as we had last year. So I guess you could say that's a 20% increase. And that's pretty consistent for all those areas that I listed.
Well, let's deal with housing first here. What protections do renters, for example, have who are unemployed due to the pandemic?
Well, we started off with the CARES Act. And when that ended in September, we had the CDC moratorium. The order went into effect September 4th. And essentially, a person, if they're affected by the pandemic, they're not able to pay their rent, they can complete a CDC moratorium declaration. When we advise people, we advise them to give that to their landlord. If the landlord's represented by an attorney, we advise them to get it to the landlord's attorney. Or if they don't know who that is, and there's some proceeding in the court, to give it to the court. Our response or the response that people are receiving to those types of declarations are mixed. A number of attorneys are basically stopping the eviction action once they receive that declaration. Courts are not going through with the evictions if they get them. And some attorneys are arguing that the CDC doesn't have authority in North Dakota. It doesn't apply to their particular set of circumstances. So, life goes on.
Now, at the end of March, the North Dakota Supreme Court suspended housing evictions. Is that still in effect?
No. I think what the court did was they took measures to protect the court itself then.
Ah.
There's definitely been a slow up, and different courts have done different things. you know, if you monitor the Supreme Court website, I mean, certain courthouses are not open to the public unless you do certain things. So, I mean, we've been going through a number of different things. Courts are struggling to provide a forum, and that's difficult to protect the people that work in the courthouse and to do that. So.
Well, let's look at it from the other side of this issue, and that's there are renters, there are landlords. Some landlords, their only means of income is what they rent out to. So do you provide legal assistance to landlords who face financial hardship or bankruptcy because renters can't pay?
Well, we have an eligibility process, and so a person has to be financially eligible. You know, we have different grants that allow us to go a little bit higher. Typically, we look at 125% of poverty as being the base amount. And when we have some other grants, we're able to go higher than that. And we did get some COVID money, and we decided that we would try to help people up to 250%. Still, for a family with all the other commitments and everything that's going on, that's not a whole lot. For example, a person, one person household, you know, for 125% of poverty, that would be, you know, $1,329 a month income, or $15,900 a year. So, and if you go up, we've been able to help more people and approaching it that way, but we still have, you know, more need than we can meet.
Has the severity of the pandemic, and it's been going on now for months, resulted in any shortcuts in the ways you and your clients and maybe their creditors come to terms?
You know, again, I see landlords trying to work with tenants. I think they understand it's not the tenant's fault that, you know, the pandemic has hit us and they've not been able to work because of, you know, shutdowns or whatnot. I mean, and so many of these tenants are good tenants. They've paid their rent month after month, year after year. And, you know, I'm sure landlords don't want to lose those tenants. And it's not the landlord's fault. You know, I think the only way that we maintain, you know, housing for people and maintain, you know, landlords so they can continue to provide housing is for Congress to help.
Mm-hmm. So it's everybody's kind of waiting for the federal government to step in again and provide some assistance like the CARES Act did. But, of course, we're in a political season and that hasn't happened. Are new Americans and immigrants at particular risk?
They are typically at risk for lots of things, and the pandemic hasn't made it any better. In some ways, the population that we serve who were on a fixed income, you know, whether that be Social Security or veterans benefits or something like that, I mean, they're probably more secure because they have housing, they pay their rent every month. You know, they're probably the most secure renters out there. What we're seeing is people who are, you know, just above that, don't qualify for anything, minimum wage, working poor. They're working from paycheck to paycheck. And when that gets cut, that has a definite effect.
Does an eviction notice or ultimately eviction itself have a lasting effect on someone who needs to rent? I mean, does this dog them for a long time?
Oh, well, yeah. I'm not sure if we have any statistics on how long, but if a application for an apartment asks the question, have you ever been evicted before? You know, tenants are required to be honest, you know, and provide that information. So, you know, when things do get better, it may have an impact. I hope that people have understanding and what everybody's going through, and maybe we just zero out 2020.
Yeah.
If it comes through 2020, just don't believe it happened.
Does legal assistance of North Dakota help with bankruptcies? You're dealing with low-income people, but sometimes they've got some assets. Or what sort of piece of your business is that?
Yeah, I think we probably do around 100 to 115 cases involving bankruptcy a year. We added it to our toolkit a few years ago when we hired an attorney who's in Fargo, and he brought to us the experience of doing that. He's written some grants to provide funding for us to get the software and to provide training and stuff. And Steve Simonson has done a lot for us in that area, and we'll continue to use bankruptcy as a tool. I mean, we've saved people's homes. We've saved other property that they've had that they can't afford to lose. So it's been a tremendous tool for us.
People have been staying home, sometimes in very close quarters. Have you seen any increase in requests for help with failing marriages or domestic violence?
Family law is unfortunately always a big number for us. But yes, if our domestic violence numbers stayed the same as they were last year, and overall everything is reduced by 20%, our numbers are probably up 20% because we have the very same numbers as we did last year. So it's unfortunate. And generally, when we take a family law case, there is an element of domestic violence, whether it's ongoing or it's in the past or it's had an impact on the client's life. And that's what we try to focus our limited resources on, is helping individuals in those circumstances. But unfortunately, we only have 10 attorneys.
So you need more?
Yes. I've been working with the program now since 89. And when I started working here, we had more staff than we do now. But the other problem that we have is not just numbers, but being able to retain staff. And I blame the Bakken for part of that problem. Is, we can't hire attorneys for, the amount that we can offer them, and expect to, be able to keep them forever. Legal services for years, as well as I can remember, has been kind of a launching pad. An attorney comes to us and gets some experience and then goes someplace where they can make more money.
Well, it sounds like people are falling through the cracks. If you don't have enough attorneys and there's demand out there, do you have any sense of what the expense of that is, or the human expense of that is, to not have legal assistance and basically be left on your own?
Yeah. Well, it's a cost that people, I'm sure they can't quantify,
Mm-hmm.
When you lose your home, I'm not sure how you can really put that in perspective monetarily. The effects that go with that, and whether you lose your home from eviction because of a pandemic, or you lose your home because of domestic violence, it's a huge disruption. Often people just want to resolve issues. We certainly help with that. We certainly have a lot of success, probably more so than not, because the cases that we're taking are the ones that we see that there needs to be something done, and once we get that before a court, often that decision could be made for our client. And so you'd like to think that legal services would be the organization that's always pushing the envelope to help people, and that way we don't even get to that point. There's so many people that need our help, and we're able to help the neediest of the needy.
From your perspective, has the state of North Dakota responded effectively to the economic hardships imposed by the pandemic?
Well, you know, there's some things that I think North Dakota's done better than others. You know, they're trying. I mean, the Brent Bridge, the resources that the state received, trying to lock down long-term care, you know, all those things that they've tried to do, if things would have been received as well as it was right at the beginning, if we could have maintained, you know, that level of protection, we certainly wouldn't be in the boat that we're in now. But that's, you know, that's unfortunately, it's like the governor trying to herd cats.
Rich LeMay is the Executive Director for Legal Assistance of North Dakota. Rich, thanks for spending time with us today.
You're welcome.
More Main Street in a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
And by Benedictine Living Center of Garrison, providing long-term skilled nursing care, short-stay rehabilitation, outpatient therapy, and assisted and independent living. A member of the Benedictine Health System, blcgarrison.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. As his name suggests, Hamzak Amusa Kariko is not native to the U.S. He's from Togo, and now he lives in Grand Forks, where he works and finds time to teach a drumming style from his homeland to a young apprentice. His work was featured in an episode of the Prairie Pulse television show.
When I play drum, I usually tell people that I have two hearts. One is inside me, and the second one is in the drum. Anytime I play drum, I feel very happy. And I cannot sit in front of a drum and not touch it. Never gonna happen. I was born in Togo, in Lomé, the capital city of Togo. And then I grew up in Lomé, and then I went to school there. When I get to the university, I was already involved with theater. And then when I was in France in 2003, one of my friends submitted my application for the diversity visa. And then I won, and then they gave me, I think, about 6 months or a year to move to the US. Where I grew up in Lomé, it's called Nyekonakwe. So every Sunday, there was a group of community members who would get together, and then they would just drum. And then as a kid, we'd be around them, you know, listening to the music, you know, moving on some of those beats. And sometimes if you get a chance, you will be allowed to, you know, touch some of those drums. It was just like a natural talent for me. Somebody asked me if I can still feel my hand. I said, oh, actually, I don't think about it.
Cameroon in Africa. I met Hamzak in an end of year party. So he met me and was like, oh, I like your dancing stuff and tell me more about yourself. So I told him, then he's like, oh, there's an Africa Art Arena that's in Grand Forks. He would like me to join. I was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna look forward to that.
She has a lot of talent. So the apprenticeship is an opportunity for her to work with her in a more structured environment than just like her coming to the African Art Arena and then just learning. It just happened that she wanted to learn, and she's also ready to make the sacrifice needed. So for me, sometimes when I'm sleeping, I can wake up in the middle of the night and try to design something for us because of her willingness to learn. We find most of the time the chemistry, and then I would let her lead. So once she does something that I like, I said, well, we're going to work on that one, instead of just me trying to impose my know-how on her. She's a versatile performer. She can do it all.
Being with Hamza, he has like taught me how to like navigate the stage while acting. like to move the step to take and the voice and the tone to use in a particular scene. It has been great. Like, I'm happy.
He ran into the field and saw what has happened. He cried out and he found that there had been a big hole in the face of Thorn. His father heard the cry and came running. Where there had been beautiful rows of curls, they were now filled with scattered stalks and broken leaves. The father picked up the leaf and cried, singing, "Oh, Tiro, oh, Namakudo, oh, Nangomenjo, Nasio, Nanai, Pode, Pumba, Lama, Nawe, Tiro, oh, Namakudo."
I wasn't really exposed to my ethnic drumming from the Kotokoli people, and the only time I got a chance to hear that music when I lost my grandma. People from our village came to celebrate her life, and I heard the music. I've never heard it before. And then I start dancing on it. I wouldn't stop. I was trying to play that drum, but it was a no, you cannot touch those drums. And I was like, okay, but I need to play this drum. Some people call it betekle, and if you go to other places, they have other names for it. We call it basa, which means the people from basa used to play. Anytime I touch that drum, it just feels like my grandma is still alive. One of the drums is called djembe. It's the most popular drum in Africa. The smaller one, we call it dondo. It's more of a talking drum.
Being in Africa, Africa has like so many languages. And in my country alone, Cameroon, we have over 250 different languages. But when we come together, when they play the music and the rhythm, you feel like you are connected to the people singing it, even though you cannot really understand.
Maybe one day she's going to be the one sitting here doing the same thing with another person. You know, she's going to be the master, and then that other person will be the apprenticeship. So the dream is to keep our tradition going in the new environment we are in.
Grand Forks resident Hamza Kamusa Kariko and the drumming style he brought from his native Togo. You can find this feature and other Prairie Pulse television shows at prairiepublic.org. Coming up on Main Street, our weekly discussion of the headlines with Dave Thompson. Then Matt Olin reviews a new documentary about UND's former athletic nickname. First, a news update.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The issue of who gets to serve in a District 8 House seat is before the North Dakota Supreme Court. Here's Prairie Public's Dave Thompson.
One of the two Republican candidates, David Ondahl, died in October from COVID-19. His name could not be taken off the ballot. He collected enough votes, however, to be elected. Acting on the opinion of Attorney General Wayne Stengem, the district's Republican Party Executive Committee picked Representative Jeff Delzer to fill the seat. Delzer lost his re-election bid in the primary. Meanwhile, Governor Burgum, whose Political Action Committee spent money to defeat Delzer, said the Constitution gives him the power to appoint because Ondahl was not seated. And the Democrats say the seat should go to Catherine Volochenko, who finished third in the general election. Attorney Robert Pathroff, representing Burgum, told the court the law District 8 Republicans used to appoint Delzer refers to someone already in office, and that means the governor has the authority under the Constitution to make that appointment.
The court only needs to answer one simple question to resolve this dispute. Has the legislature enacted a law that provides a method to fill a vacancy in office resulting from the pre-election death of a winning legislative candidate? The answer to that question is no.
Stengem argued the Constitution gives the ultimate authority over determining its members to the legislature.
My point is that it's hard to imagine a more egregious incursion into the prerogatives of a legislative body.
Attorney David Thompson, who represented Volochenko, argued because Ondahl was not eligible to serve, his votes should be thrown out.
Our position is this. There is no vacancy here, number one. Catherine Volochenko was the second highest vote getter of the qualified candidates.
The High Court has taken that case under advisement. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
In yet another deadly daily update, the State Health Department has confirmed the deaths of 23 more people related to COVID-19. The statewide death toll is now 818. The patients ranged in age from their 50s to their 100s and were from Barnes, Cass, Grand Forks, Hettinger, McLean, Ramsey, Richland, Stark, Stutzman, and Ward counties. Out of 10,185 tests, 1,408 new individuals from 51 counties have also tested positive. Today's positivity rate is 14.99%, and there are currently 9,915 active confirmed cases. And UND has issued new guidelines for the Thanksgiving holiday. Under them, students who have on-campus requirements such as classes or employment should stay in Grand Forks. Students already online and who are going home for the holiday should finish the semester at home and return to campus in January. All semester finals will be online. The December commencement will be virtual, and staff will be able to work remotely if possible. UND President Andrew Armacost sent a video message to students.
This is naturally a stressful time of the year. And so with COVID and with the uncertainty of the pandemic, it adds another dimension to those stress levels. That's natural. And so what I want to remind you is to take care of each other. Look out for the well-being of your classmates, of your coworkers, of your friends. And let's finish this semester together.
UND still plans to start spring semester classes January 11th. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
All right, the old wire machine is humming in the background. It means it's time for our weekly news chat with our news director, Dave Thompson. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Doug. How are you doing?
Well, you've had a busy day today.
Oh,
you just got back from the governor's briefing.
Certainly did. And the governor's briefing had a number of special guests. They had the legislative leaders from the House and the Senate. They had a couple of doctors and hospital administrators, one from Essentia Health and one from the Hettinger Health Facility. And they had a couple of school superintendents talking about some of the issues that are going on in their facilities as well.
And the news is not good. We still have lots of cases and lots of deaths.
That's right. But remember, and, you know, these are kind of lagging indicators because you put in a mask mandate and it doesn't mean immediately you're going to see less cases. It's going to take a little while for the germination period for the COVID for that to get through, and that's probably about a 14-day period. So we'll see how it goes. But, I mean, these are very, very serious numbers in North Dakota.
Yeah, they sure are. Meanwhile, there's some resistance that's been building among a few sheriffs in North Dakota about enforcing the statewide mask mandate.
Now, that was talked about at the briefing, too, and Governor Burgum said some of the sheriffs are saying we want to do education first. And that's not a bad thing, he said. But he said if you have some sheriffs who are basically going to be not enforcing it, even if there's a complaint, well, it's kind of like a legislature passing a law and that they say, we don't like that law, we're not going to enforce it. Say you've got a 65-mile-per-hour speed limit, oh, we don't like that law, we're not going to enforce it. So there's a bit of a give and take on that.
Well, there was a blistering editorial in the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead today saying essentially just that. Mm-hmm. In what universe is it acceptable for law enforcement officers to simply ignore certain statutes? That's a sentence right out of the editorial.
Exactly. And this, because it's an emergency order, does carry the weight of law.
Well, we also have another kerfuffle or controversy building among the leadership of one of the largest health providers in our region, Sanford Health. The CEO and president has basically communicated with his thousands of employees saying he has recovered from COVID and he's not going to wear a mask now because that would be a symbolic gesture, and that is getting pushback.
You know, you shake your head about that saying, hey, what's going on here? Because even though you may have recovered, we really don't know all that much yet about this virus. Can you get it again? There's some studies that say perhaps you can catch it a second time. There are other studies saying that you can be a super spreader even though you have had COVID and have recovered. There are some things that are just that don't add up, and I'm just saying that. And I know that there was some eyebrows raised at the governor's briefing when that was brought up by a reporter.
Well, we'll be talking with Tessa Johnson. She's the head of the North Dakota Nurses Association on Monday, and one mm-hmm. of the things we'll be asking about is, of course, hospital capacity. Are we reaching it? And will there be staff if we do reach it?
And that's the big issue. The big issue is not so much capacity. The capacity and staff are intertwined. So you might have beds available, but you may not have staff to staff those beds. And we're getting 120 nurses into North Dakota. 60 are going to be military, 60 from a temporary agency. That's going to help probably mitigate some of this.
Well, I know that they're hiring these so-called traveling nurses. I think you just referred to that. And I'm wondering if there are nurses who would normally be working in North Dakota who are just traveling because the money's better.
That's a possibility, and that's an interesting question that I think needs to be asked.
Because there's a huge premium being paid for these traveling nurses.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about another issue that is related to the pandemic, as everybody seems to
pretty
be
much
these days.
Is.
This story you wrote earlier this week, yesterday as a matter of fact, human service centers are open for on-site and community-based services because there's a desperate need.
Now, it's interesting. In talking to the person from Jamestown, from South Central Human Services Center, he said that when the pandemic first hit, they went a lot on online things and you know, virtual visits. But then they found out that there are a lot of people who need to have that human contact. So the doors are open again, and they're saying they have to balance virtual visits with in-person visits because there are certain people, COVID fatigue does not quite describe what's going on with a lot of people. There's a feeling of helplessness among some people about this whole pandemic thing. And the human service centers are saying, okay, we're open. We're going to come hear you. We will go out in the community and talk to you as well.
Well, loneliness and isolation are not good for people who are in mental and emotional and behavioral stress.
No, and then you've got the added strain of the holidays, and they're trying to limit the amount of people in Thanksgiving gatherings. And I understand why they're doing that, but, you know, that's not necessarily all that great for mental health, I guess.
Yeah, family can be supportive and can
help.
That's
right. That's true.
And we can also share a deadly virus as well. So we're all walking a tightrope.
We certainly are.
Well, let's go to the political story of the month, and perhaps there'll be some resolution on this soon. But what a kerfuffle in District 8.
I know. And just to bring listeners up to speed, one of the candidates, David Ondal, passed away from COVID in October. He's on the ballot. It was too late to get his name off the ballot, so he took second in the race. Technically, you elected a dead person. I don't mean to be cruel by saying that, but yes, you did. So the attorney general is opine that the District 8 Executive Committee could pick a successor. But the problem is the person was not seated yet. The legislative session begins December 1st. And yet this is all coming to a head before December 1st. The governor said, hey, I want to appoint a person here too. And he's quoting the Constitution saying, you know, there's not a specific law that will address this point, what happens if somebody dies when they're on the ballot. There's no law. So he's saying the Constitution in Article 5 gives him the authority to actually appoint somebody to take that seat. Then the Democrats come in and they're saying, wait a second, he was not eligible to be elected. So the third place candidate, who happens to be a Democrat, Catherine Voloshenko, should be named as the other legislator in District 8. Now, this has all landed on the Supreme Court's lap. And I'll tell you, that's going to be one to sift through, I think.
Well, I don't think I should practice election law on the air, but it does seem odd.
It does
that
seem
somebody
odd.
Who was not an eligible candidate but whose name was on the ballot, could not serve, is somehow granted votes. He died a month before the election.
Right, he did. October 3rd is when he died, yes.
So you have to – are we figuring here that people voted for him out of appreciation for his life
now, here's
in
the,
service or because he was a Republican or why?
Here's one of the arguments that came up, that it was opined by people that perhaps he got votes because they didn't like the Democrat on the ballot. And there's some feeling that you shouldn't vote negatively. You should vote positively. Your vote should be a positive thing to elect somebody. So that's another argument that's out there, too.
Well,
I think they call that the American plan or something like that, or the American proposal.
Your namesake, the attorney David Thompson, mm-hmm. Has been arguing the Voloshenko case. And she was the second highest living vote getter.
As I said, this thing has so many twists and turns. You could not write a screenplay and sell it to Hollywood with this plot because nobody would buy it. They wouldn't believe it.
Well, I suspect the legislature is going to look at election law and maybe chink up this hole in the wall. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's some encouraging news because we do like to look at the bright side. North
Absolutely.
Dakota's airline passenger boardings continue to slowly recover.
Right. They're up to 47% of capacity compared to a year ago. Now, 47% doesn't sound like a great number, but think back and when the pandemic started, it was 5% capacity in North Dakota. So it's come a long way, but there's a long more way to go.
And it's a reminder because if you look at that number, that means roughly 100,000 people get on a plane in North Dakota every month.
That's right.
So 5,000 back in April, 47,000 in October, and lots of capacity there as well, I'm sure.
Right, and the Aeronautics Commission Director, Kyle Warner, says flights are very inexpensive right now as they're trying to fill up planes to, you know, make it at least feasible to fly a plane somewhere. And some of the airlines are adding some flights back to North Dakota, and they really cut back for a while. So we're seeing that as a positive thing. But still, with this idea about not traveling for Thanksgiving, it could be real interesting when the November numbers come out.
Well, I noted as well that Allegiant has announced they're going to put new service from Fargo to St. Petersburg, so they're going where the snowbirds go.
I think that's right, yeah.
All right. Let's talk about a couple of stories you had this week, Dave, about cancer and the causes of it and the state's prominence in terms of statistics.
Right. Now, one of the stories is pretty positive that North Dakota has a high treatment rate. As a matter of fact, we're best in the nation for treating the lung cancers.
That means we have a few lung cancer cases.
We do. If you look at that, you know, survival rate of lung cancer patients is 22.8%. Still, that's a high death rate.
Yeah.
But we're getting better on it. Now, the Lung Association also says that one of the barriers to cutting the rate of lung cancer is the fact that our taxes on tobacco are still very low. And they said there's going to be an effort in the next legislative session to try to raise those taxes.
Well, Border Fargo, of course, has a lot of tobacco sales because Minnesota's right across the river.
That is correct.
The second largest cause of lung cancer behind smoking in this next story of yours is radon.
I found that intriguing because I did not know that. And then when I'm doing the story, I go to the DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality website, and there's the banner saying we don't have any more available. We've run out of funds. So what the department has actually done is put some of these radon kits to test schools because they haven't been tested for radon in years. And then they're going to have a few available in January when it's Radon Action Month. But I thought it was interesting that radon is the second leading cause of lung cancer in North Dakota.
Colorless, odorless, tasteless gas, and
exactly.
It accumulates in basements typically.
That's correct.
All right, we check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every week. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Doug.
There's a lot going on these days, but in Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we focus on the important stuff. Here's Maeve Higgins.
The dolphin Fungi, who's like Ireland's most famous dolphin, has sadly gone missing and is presumed dead. And everyone is so upset about it.
I'm Peter Sagal. If you too are upset by the news, tune into this week's news quiz. We won't help, but we won't make it any worse. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain. Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olean. And Matt, this week, we've both seen the movie, and it's a pretty special one when it comes to North Dakota and fans of UND hockey.
Yeah, Fighting for Sioux, about an 84-minute documentary by writer, director, and editor. He did everything on it, Matt Fearn. And we were lucky enough to be able to see this, and the public will be able to see it in about a week, it sounds like, on demand in a movie theater. So that's good. But we'll give people a preview. So this is a very extensive documentary on the fight over the Fighting Sioux nickname, Doug. And you actually make a cameo in this documentary from an interview you did years ago, I believe, with Ken Baker, who was one of the many UND presidents since Tom Clifford. I think it's a good show. I enjoyed it. I think that Matt did a very professional job. It's very thorough. The interviews look great. And that's a big thing in documentaries for me. I want to see those interviews looking professionally done. You know, Earl Strindon and all these people that he interviewed, the interviews look really good. They're in different settings. And I found the documentary to be fairly even-handed. When it started, I started watching about that first 10 minutes. I thought it seemed like it was going to be kind of a pro-nickname film. It started out that way, Doug. And then eventually we do get the other side. We do get Native American leaders talking about the genocide and, you know, this name should be retired. And of course, the NCAA putting all kinds of pressure on UND. And so it really takes you through the battle over the nickname, the eventual changing of the nickname, the acceptance or non-acceptance by fans of the nickname, and retiring the logo. Ralph Engelstad, of course, that is covered in the documentary as well. So I found it very thorough. Matt did his research. I think that people around this area will enjoy the documentary and find it very interesting. I might have shaved 10 minutes off it if it would have been me. You know, you get those series of sound bites where about five different people essentially say the same thing. So yeah, that could have been shaved a little bit. I would say the documentary slightly tilts time-wise toward the pro-nickname crowd. I think if I was to add up the sound bites, but that's okay. This is not an equal time film. Documentaries can take whatever point of view they want. So I think this is of huge interest to this region, and people will be able to see it soon. And I found it very thorough, very professionally done. Matt did a nice job in the editing process.
I would agree with you. The film looks very good. It's got a lot of eye appeal, a lot of really good photography in it. I would agree with you that it could be a bit more compact. The thing for me that was most intriguing about it was that I looked at this as Fighting Over Sioux as a use of that logo and that mascot as a point of departure to talk about the bigger issue here, which is Native issues, the relationship that people in the state have had with the tribal leaders and groups over the history of the state. And this debate, this argument kind of brought that to a head in many ways. I found the piece quite nuanced and full of detail that is very important to fully understanding everybody's point of view.
I agree, Doug. I like that Matt did veer off into issues on reservations. There was a lot of talk about, you know, a nickname is not as important as what's going on in Fort Totten, what's going on in Fort Yates, and the endless poverty and the cycle of poverty that continues on many of the reservations in North Dakota, some less so than others, of course. So that was good. I like that he put that in. So I did find it a very even-handed documentary and nuanced. It wasn't just about the nickname. It wasn't just about rabid hockey fans or rabid fans of all kinds of UND sports. There is a larger issue here, and that is, you know, the reservation system. They talk about the boarding schools. There's a great soundbite. Remember the soundbite, Doug, where the man talks about he said one word that wasn't English and they put him in a closet for it. I mean, can you imagine such a thing?
He said the word huh, which meant yes.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
He was up at Fort Totten boarding school. It's just awful. Some horrible stories that we all know, unfortunately, up in this region. So, but I agree with you. It's very professionally done. He does kind of that sped up editing where you kind of get time lapse. I like that as well. Great shots of campus, great shots of UND. And I thought his unearthing of the news clips was very well done. Lots of people in there that you and I know have worked with. So that was interesting as well. I do think this will be of heavy regional interest. As I said, maybe I could have cut 10 minutes out of it, something like that. But that's me having produced 12 or 13 of these documentaries. You know, I see things that maybe other people don't see, but that's a minor criticism.
And we also were reminded of the division that existed within the tribal interests here, particularly Spirit Lake and Standing Rock, who had Spirit Lake had a vote in favor of the Fighting Sioux logo and mascot, and Standing Rock did not have a vote. The tribal elders or the tribal leaders made a decision. It was a considered decision. It wasn't something they did preemptively, but it really gave you a peek into governance and how complicated something that might have seemed simple at the time really wasn't. It was very, very nuanced, very complex discussions. It's a thoughtful piece, and it's very worthwhile reviewing that piece of our history.
I think it was good that Matt not only had interviews with Native American leaders who were against the nickname, but he had interviews with Native Americans who were for the nickname and loved the nickname. So this is not a one-size-fits-all issue. As we discovered, Doug, having covered this story like both of us have over the years, it is not a 100%, oh, we hate the nickname within the Native American community. It's a very divisive issue within the Native American community, and that's interesting to me as well, and I thought that was handled well by Matt Fearn.
And I was really intrigued with the treatment of the fellow who designed the logo. Was it Brendan Beer?
Yes.
The fellow who is the graphic artist, the artist, actually, a very accomplished artist, and the the realization that he was Ojibwe,
right.
And of course he was designing a logo about the Sioux, and these were traditional enemies, not now, but I mean back in the frontier days, they were not friendly tribes with each mm-hmm. other. So that was a wrinkle in it that I had not realized.
I didn't realize that part either. That was surprising to me. So the fact that you and I have been around this issue for 20-some years, I did learn some things that were new to me. So that's also a good sign of a good documentary. Did I learn anything I didn't know going into this? And I did. I did. I think it's a very nuanced issue. I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all issue. I think ultimately the NCAA came in and basically said it wouldn't have mattered how the vote would have gone, would have ended up within Native American communities. I think the NCAA, to me, sounded like they'd made up their mind that this nickname was going to have to be retired. And UND just eventually accepted it because they were losing revenue, losing opponents, that kind of thing.
All right. We've been to the movies, and it's a good one for all of us to watch, Fighting Over Sioux. Now it's time for a little Oscar trivia, and I try to mix it up a little bit this week, Matt.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you, what won the best feature-length documentary at the 2012 Academy Awards?
Was it Searching for Sugar Man?
It was not.
It was not.
It has a relationship to athletics.
Hoop Dreams was too old. That's not it. I'm not as good
I'm
at the
help
doc.
You out here. Undefeated.
Okay.
Directed by Daniel Lindsay and T.J. Martin. It was released in 2011. It won Best Feature-Length Documentary at the 2012 Academy Awards. It's about three underprivileged kids from an inner-city Memphis school and their volunteer coach who tries to help them beat the odds on and off the field. And I guess it was very inspirational to everybody who saw it.
I did not see that one, so that was a good question.
Well, every now and then, I stump you. We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
It's a parade of Broadway's best Irving Berlin tunes.
Letting her seat.
When Great Performances checks into Holiday Inn. A nostalgic new show that's a song and dance delight. Take a wonderfully old-fashioned walk that's filled with favorites.
Dancing cheek to cheek.
In Irving Berlin's Holiday Inn, the Broadway musical. On Great Performances.
Watch Great Performances tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 20th. The want ads have been a staple in newspapers for generations. The simple premise of posting sale items or help wanted ads has continued in virtually every community. Today, those ads from the past provide a glimpse into the services, wages, and community of the decades gone by. Here's a sampling of Fargo Forum newspaper ads from this week in 1909. For sale, the best-located ice cream and soda fountain business in this city. Best of reasons for selling. Lost, pocketbook containing about $55. Reward if returned to Forum office. For sale, meat market, everything up to date, slaughterhouse, windmill, and 4 acres fenced for yards. If interested, address the Nome Meat Market, Nome, North Dakota. For rent, the finest horseshoeing shop in North Dakota, City of Fargo, all equipped, in connection with Carter's Veterinary Hospital. Only sober men need apply. Good law practice in live North Dakota town for sale for the price of library and furniture. A hustling young fellow can step into a live practice and make good quick. Complete moving picture outfit. Powers No. 5 machine, chairs and electric light plant, 8-horsepower gasoline engine, right for particulars, Castleton, North Dakota. Help wanted, 50 more young men to learn telegraphy at once, positions guaranteed, Fargo School of Telegraphy. Can furnish permanent employment to 3 educated Christian men, YMCA. Help wanted, good girl for general housework, modern house, power washing machine. Wanted, washwoman to do washing in her own home. For sale, a lady's dyed otter coat, size 38, nearly good as new. Too large for present owner, will sell at low, low price. And finally, on this date in November, leftovers. We have a good stock of assorted calendars left of our 1910 line, which we will sell at low prices. If you want calendars, send at once for samples and prices before the choice subjects are gone. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hospitals face an awful reality of more and more COVID patients, and yet many communities, no mask mandates, no social distancing, and people eat out as if there was no virus.
I had to get out because I almost had a panic attack. I was like, what is going on with people? Like, why are we still doing this?
Our rural communities are pushing urban hospitals past capacity. That story and the latest political news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for our broadcast and online Main Street. You can always find the show after the broadcast or after listening online at prairiepublic.org. Monday on our show, nurses are among the heroes during the pandemic, and they have a lot of concerns. We'll talk with the president of the North Dakota Nurses Association, Tessa Johnson. And we'll share a conversation between South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lori Walsh and Denise Kiernan about the book We Gather Together. Kiernan's work deals with the timely topic of gratitude. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.